On a bright Sicilian morning in the 5th century BCE, the city of Acragas rises from the sea in terraces of stone and dust. Temples crown the ridge above, their columns catching the sun. Below, olive groves and vineyards climb the slopes. In the streets, merchants call out prices, children weave through the crowds, and somewhere, perhaps in a house near the city wall, or walking among companions on a country path, moves a man whose reputation will swell to legend. Physician. Prophet, poet, wonder worker, and philosopher. His name is Empedocles, and he will try to do something audacious with his thought, to reconcile the severe logic of Parmenides with the obvious fact that the world seems full of many things that change. Empedocles was born in Acragas, on the southern coast of Sicily, around 495 BCE, a generation after Parmenides, and roughly contemporary with Anaxagoras and the young Socrates. Acragas was one of the richest Greek cities of its time, famed for its splendid temples and for the extravagance of its citizens. Later writers say its people built as if they were to live forever and feasted as if they were to die tomorrow. It is into this world of luxury and civic ambition that Empedocles steps, but his own persona stands slightly askew to it all. He cultivates an image that is part holy man, part scientist, part politician. He wears purple robes and a golden wreath, goes barefoot like a mystic, and claims powers of healing and prophecy. Yet he also writes technical verses about nature, anatomy, and perception, and he plunges into political struggles, siding with the democratic faction against oligarchic rule. We do not have any prose work from him. What remains are fragments of two long poems, written in hexameter verse, one traditionally called On Nature, and another called Purifications. In On Nature, he explains what the world is made of and how it changes. In Purifications, he presents a religious moral vision of the soul's fall and possible redemption. The two are not separate in his mind. For Empedocles, understanding the structure of the cosmos and understanding the soul's condition are bound together. To know what we are made of is already to know something about how we should live. The first problem he confronts is the one posed by Parmenides. If nothing can come from nothing, and if what truly is cannot pass away into nothing, then what are we to make of the obvious facts of birth and death, growth and decay, mixing and separation? Parmenides had resolved this by declaring the world of becoming a kind of illusion. Empedocles refuses to deny the rich variety of the world. He sees plants sprouting from seeds, animals being born, cities rising and falling, fires igniting and going out. He wants to honor Parmenides' insight that being cannot emerge from non-being without sacrificing the reality of change. His solution is to say that the basic constituents of the world never come into being or perish. They are eternal, ungenerated, and indestructible. He calls them roots rather than elements: earth, air, fire, and water. These four are always there, always themselves. What we call coming to be and passing away are, at a deeper level, just the mixing and unmixing of these roots in different proportions. Something that looks like a new thing, say a plant, has not appeared from nothing. It is a particular ratio of earth, air, fire, and water woven together. When the plant dies and rots, no being has been lost. The roots that made it up have simply separated and gone off into other combinations. Empedocles expresses this in a vivid line: there is no birth of any mortal thing, nor end in death's destroying, but only mingling and interchange of what is mingled. In another, he says, "Fools, for they think that what before was not comes into being, or that anything dies and perishes utterly." The target of his scorn is not only ordinary common sense, but also those poets and thinkers who speak as if something could arise out of sheer absence. He insists instead that at the fundamental level, nothing is added and nothing subtracted. The total stock of being remains the same. Only its arrangements shift. But four roots are not enough. If change is to be more than a random reshuffling, if cycles and structures are to emerge, there must be principles that drive the roots together and apart in intelligible ways. For this, Empedocles posits two forces, love and strife. Love, philia, is the principle that draws unlike things together into unity. Strife, nakos, is the principle that separates and isolates them. Under the influence of love, the four roots blend more and more intimately, tending toward a harmonious one. Under the influence of strife, the blends are torn apart, and each root is driven back into its own realm, a world of pure fire, pure water, pure earth, pure air. In the far past and the far future, Empedocles imagines, these forces reach extremes. At one end of the cosmic cycle, love reigns alone. All the roots are perfectly unified in a spherical godlike one, which he calls the Spheros. It has no limbs, no eyes, no separate parts, but it is alive and blessed, a divine harmony of all things. At the other end of the cycle, strife reigns alone. The roots are fully separated, each in its own domain, in a kind of cosmic dismemberment. Our present world lies somewhere between these extremes, in a phase where love and strife are both at work, partially combining and partially separating things, giving rise to the myriad creatures, plants, and phenomena we see. Empedocles thus preserves Parmenides' insight. There is a phase of the cosmos, the Spheros, in which reality is genuinely one, without internal difference. But he refuses to confine reality to that phase. Being for him is not a timeless monolith, but a cycle, from unity to separation and back again. Love and strife are not moralized in the simple way their names might suggest. Love is not simply good. Strife is not simply evil. Without strife, there would be no plurality, no distinct beings, no world of experience. Without love, there would be no binding, no organisms, no stable configurations. The drama of the cosmos is the alternation and interplay of these two. Within this framework, organisms like us appear as temporary arrangements of roots under the play of love and strife. Our bodies are blends in which earth, air, fire, and water have come together in certain proportions. Empedocles was particularly interested in the physiology of perception and thought. He proposed that each root in us responds to the corresponding root outside us. We perceive fire by fire, water by water, earth by earth, air by air. The eye, for instance, he imagined as a mixture of elements that fits with light. The ear as a cavity that resonates with certain motions in the air. In a striking anticipation of later theories, he suggested that sensation involves material effluences streaming from objects and entering our sense organs, where they meet matching structures. Thought, too, he saw as a function of mixture. By earth, we see earth, he says. By water, water. By air, shining air. By fire, destructive fire. By love, love. By strife, strife. Our capacity to know things depends on the presence in us of the same roots and forces that constitute the world. Knowledge is not a disembodied activity. It is the world, in one of its configurations, becoming aware of itself. This idea will echo later in Stoic and even in some modern materialist views, but in Empedocles, it is still expressed in the language of roots and cosmic forces. Alongside this natural philosophy runs a darker, more urgent teaching about the soul. In the Purifications, Empedocles speaks in the first person as a daimon, a divine being who has fallen from blessedness and is now condemned to wander through various mortal forms, plant, animal, human, because of an ancient blood guilt. I have been once already a boy and a girl, a bush and a bird and a fish leaping from the sea, he says. The soul, in his vision, is a divine exile. Its current embodied life is part of a long, painful cycle of reincarnations, a punishment for some primordial crime involving bloodshed and perjury. The moral core of this doctrine is clear. To kill, especially to shed blood, is not a trivial act. It violates a cosmic order. Empedocles links this to his famous vegetarianism. If souls wander through all living forms, if animals and humans bear within them the same kind of divine exile, then to kill and eat animals is to perpetuate a kind of sacrilege. He tells a horrifying story of a man who, in making a sacrifice, unknowingly slaughters his own father in the form of an animal. The point is not that this literally happens in everyday life, but that, given the transmigration of souls, our casual violence may be spiritually fratricidal in ways we do not see. He also criticizes the bloody rituals of traditional Greek religion. Sacrifices of oxen and goats, he suggests, are not pious offerings, but continuations of the very guilt that keeps souls trapped in the cycle. True piety is purification, abstaining from bloodshed, practicing justice, cultivating harmony in oneself so that one can eventually escape the cycle and return to the company of the blessed. There is in this a strong Orphic Pythagorean flavor. Empedocles stands at the intersection of scientific cosmology and mystery religion. He believes both that we can give a material account of how the world's parts combine and separate, and that the soul is engaged in a long moral journey governed by cosmic justice. His own persona seems to have embodied this duality. Later anecdotes portray him as a charismatic healer and wonder worker. He is said to have stopped a plague by diverting polluted winds, to have raised a dead woman, to have controlled weather. These tales are likely myths built on a kernel of truth. He probably did practice medicine, understood something about environmental causes of disease, and used his rhetorical and practical skill to help his city. But they also express how his contemporaries experienced him, as someone whose knowledge of nature was inseparable from spiritual authority. The most famous legend about his death captures this ambivalence perfectly. One tradition says that Empedocles, seeking to prove his divinity, leaped into the crater of Mount Etna so that he would vanish and be thought to have been taken up by the gods. The volcano, however, betrayed him by spitting out one of his bronze sandals, revealing his fraud. This story, almost certainly fictional, is a sharp moral about hubris. It suggests that a man who claimed to know the secrets of nature and the path of purification may have been tempted to present himself as more than mortal. At the same time, the very existence of such a story shows how closely his image was tied to the idea of someone standing at the boundary between human and divine, between earth and sky. In the more sober testimony of his fragments, though, what stands out is not self-aggrandizement, but a kind of tragic tenderness. He speaks of the souls wandering far from their divine home, drifting up and down the ways of dreadful life, at the mercy of strife's separating power. He laments the cruelty of mortal banquets where animals are slain. He urges his hearers to turn away from violence and toward harmony with the cosmic order. At the same time, he describes in precise, almost clinical terms, how blood circulates, how respiration might work, how plants draw nourishment. The same mind that can imagine the spheros, the divine one under love's total reign, can also analyze why a person's breathing changes when they exert themselves. For later thinkers, Empedocles becomes a precedent for pluralistic metaphysics. Aristotle places him among those who posited multiple elements as the substrate of things. The four elements, earth, air, fire, water, will become standard in ancient and medieval natural philosophy. Physicians and alchemists will speak of them for centuries. The idea that organisms are compounds of these elements in varying proportions becomes a commonplace. Even as science moves on to atomism and chemical elements, the Empedoclean picture of mixing and separating basic stuffs remains a powerful metaphor. His love and strife, too, exert influence. They are, in one sense, mythical names for attraction and repulsion, for forces that bind and forces that break apart. In that sense, they anticipate later notions of physical forces, but they also carry a psychological and ethical dimension, love as unifying, strife as divisive. Plato, in his Symposium and other dialogues, will take up the concept of eros as a striving toward unity. Heraclitus had already spoken of war as the father of all. Empedocles codifies the duality. The world, he says, in effect, is always moving under these two influences, toward integration, toward fracture. Moral life is lived inside that tension. From the standpoint of your series on moral philosophy, Empedocles is crucial because he ties metaphysics, physics, and ethics together in a single vision. He does not treat questions about what the world is made of as unrelated to questions about how the soul should live. The same love that binds elements into harmonious forms is in its spiritual aspect, the love that can bind soul back into unity with the divine. A sane strife that separates and isolates elements into fragmented domains is, in its spiritual aspect, the hatred and violence that drive souls further into exile. In one sense, his ethics is simple. Do not kill, especially do not shed blood. Practice justice and piety. Seek purification from the cycle of rebirth. But the justification he gives is not a set of divine commands. It is a story about the structure of reality. Killing is wrong because it goes against the deep grain of the cosmos, which in its blessed phase is unified under love. Bloodshed binds the soul more tightly to strife, to separation, and conflict. Purity is not cleanliness in a ritual sense alone. It is alignment with the phase of the cosmos in which love prevails. Empedocles also offers a way to absorb the Eleatic critique without falling into despair about the world of experience. If Parmenides is right, at some level, that true being cannot come and go, then our hopes and fears attach to particular forms, bodies, possessions, even individual lives, are misplaced. But if Empedocles is also right, the forms themselves are not illusions. They are real arrangements of roots under love and strife. They do not come from nothing, and they do not go to nothing. Even when a particular configuration dissolves, the underlying being continues. That thought can be both comforting and disquieting. Comforting, because it suggests that nothing is utterly lost. Disquieting, because it suggests that our individuality is not ultimate. In a strange way, Empedocles stands as a kind of mediator between the cold unity of Parmenides and the warm multiplicity of ordinary life. He lends dignity to the many, without surrendering the insight of the one. He tells us that the same four roots and two forces are at work in stones, trees, animals, oceans, stars, and our own bodies and brains. To know ourselves is to know that we are temporary knots in a much larger weave, and that the pattern of that weave is governed by a cosmic rhythm of uniting and separating. Empedocles also offered one of the earliest speculative accounts of how living creatures might have arisen, an account that in some ways anticipates much later thinking about natural selection. In the phase of the cosmos, when love is on the rise, but strife has not yet been overcome, the elements, he suggests, combine in wild and varied ways. At first there are strange, partial formations, heads without necks, arms without shoulders, eyes without faces, wandering through the world in grotesque isolation. Elsewhere, torsos appear without limbs or other mismatched parts. In time, under the continued influence of love, some of these parts join up. Occasionally, combinations occur that are viable, whole creatures with functioning sets of organs. These survive and reproduce. Others, monstrosities unable to sustain themselves, simply vanish. In this quasi-mythic language, Empedocles is doing something remarkable. He is suggesting that the fit between animal structures and their ways of life is not primarily the result of a designer fashioning each creature one by one, but the outcome of a long, unguided process of trial and error at the level of combinations. Those forms that fitted together persisted, those that did not fell away. Later readers, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries, would look back on these lines and see a kind of proto-evolutionary thinking. It would be an exaggeration to call Empedocles a Darwinian. He does not speak of species changing over time in response to environmental pressures, but he does undermine the assumption that every existing creature must have been directly and intentionally crafted in its present form. For him, the elemental roots and love's combinatory power are enough to generate a riot of forms from which only some endure. This perspective reinforces his tendency to naturalize phenomena that earlier poets had treated as the direct work of capricious gods. Just as he explains perception and thought in terms of elemental interactions, he explains the variety of life in terms of the cosmic cycle and the fitness of mixtures. The gods, when he mentions them, are often more like names for cosmic realities than like anthropomorphic personalities. Zeus, Hera, Nestes, and Idaneus appear in his poetry as ways of speaking about fire, air, water, and earth. The Spheros, the divine one under love, is a god, but not one you could picture with human features. In this, Empedocles contributes to the gradual demythologizing of Greek cosmology. The world becomes something with an internal logic, not a stage for the whims of quarreling deities. His influence on later philosophy is diffuse but deep. Plato clearly knows his work. In dialogues like the Timaeus, where a divine craftsman orders pre-existing chaotic matter according to rational patterns, you can hear resonances of Empedocles' concern with mixture and proportion. Aristotle engages him more directly, critiquing his attempt to explain motion through love and strife, while borrowing the four elements for his own physics. For Aristotle, Empedocles' influence on later philosophy is diffuse but deep. However, Plato clearly knows his work. In dialogues like the Timaeus, where a divine craftsman orders pre-existing chaotic matter according to rational patterns, you can hear resonances of Empedocles' concern with mixture and proportion. Mistake is to treat love and strife as external forces acting on the elements, rather than seeing form and purpose as immanent in natural things. Yet Aristotle acknowledges Empedocles as a serious predecessor, someone who recognized that change must be understood as reconfiguration of persistent stuffs, not as something emerging from nothing. The medical writers of the Hippocratic tradition also owe something to Empedocles. When they speak of health as a balance of qualities, hot, cold, wet, dry, and disease as an imbalance, they are drawing on the same basic picture of the body as a compound whose well-being depends on harmonious mixture. Empedocles himself, in the Fragments on Physiology, insists that blood is the seat of understanding, that respiration works through channels in the body connecting to the outside air, that plants have their own kind of life based on the flow of moisture and heat. These are speculative and often wrong in detail, but they share with later medicine the aim of explaining the body without recourse to magical agency. Even when he speaks of daimones and divine exile, Empedocles does not invoke supernatural interventions to explain physical processes. His political engagements, though less well documented, fit the pattern of a thinker who refused to separate the cosmic from the civic. One tradition says he helped overthrow a tyrannical government in Acragas and then refused the offer of kingship or sole rule, preferring equality under law. Whether or not this is literally true, it reflects the way later ages imagined the coherent Empedoclean stance. A man who teaches cosmic harmony and the unity of all living things should, in politics, oppose domination and bloodshed. If love is the binding of unlike into a living whole, and strife the tearing apart into hostile fragments, then the polis, too, is healthiest when governed by something like love. Not sentimentality, but a structuring principle that allows differences to coexist in an ordered unity. From a modern perspective, some of Empedocles' ideas can seem naive, even fanciful, yet the questions he is trying to answer remain ours. What are the basic constituents of reality? Are the things we see around us ultimate, or are they made of deeper, simpler stuffs? How does change occur without something coming from nothing? How can a world described in physical terms accommodate consciousness, value, and moral obligation? Empedocles' responses are framed in the vocabulary of his time. Roots, gods, love, strife, but the shape of the problems is enduring. There is a humility, too, in his admission that human beings are not at the center of the cosmic story. We are one kind of mixture among many, caught up in cycles that began long before us, and will continue long after. Our souls, in his mythic telling, are wanderers trying to find their way back to a unity that they once knew and lost. That picture has influenced religious thought as much as philosophical speculation. It offers a way of seeing ordinary life, the buying and selling, the feasting and fighting of Acragas, as a thin surface over a deeper pilgrimage of the soul. If you listen carefully to Empedocles with a moral ear, you can hear at least three strands that will braid into later Western ethics. One is the idea that there is a basic kinship among all living beings, the same roots, the same forces, the same wandering souls. This underwrites a concern for animals and a horror at bloodshed that is strikingly ahead of its time. Another is the conviction that the universe has an underlying order, a justice, in accordance with which deeds bring consequences across lifetimes. This anticipates later notions of cosmic justice, karma-like structures, and the moral significance of the soul's orientation. The third is a sense that the good life involves aligning oneself with the unifying force, love, rather than with strife. To cultivate love, harmony, and restraint is not just to be nice. It is to move in step with the deeper current of reality. When we set Empedocles alongside other figures in your series, alongside Thales' Water, Anaximander's Apeiron, Parmenides' One, Heraclitus' Flux, and the later ethical systems of Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, Christians, and moderns, he occupies a distinctive place. He is the one who refuses to separate natural philosophy, religious vision, and ethical prescription. His four roots and two forces are not mere physical posits. They are the stage on which a moral drama plays out. His daimons are not mere mythic decorations. They are us, understood under the aspect of eternity. For a listener in the 21st century, all this may feel distant in language, but close in structure. We too live in a world where scientific accounts of matter and energy sit uneasily alongside experiences of meaning, guilt, love, and longing. We too sense at times that our lives are part of larger cycles we barely grasp. We too wrestle with violence, with the temptation to treat other sentient beings as mere means rather than kin. Empedocles' voice reaches across the centuries to say, "The world you inhabit is woven by forces of union and division. The elements in your bones are the same as those in the stars. Your choices either harmonize with love or deepen the rule of strife." Physics and ethics are not strangers. They speak in different registers about the same reality. In the end, whether or not he jumped into Etna, whether or not he healed plagues or swayed assemblies, Empedocles left something more lasting than any individual deed. A way of imagining the cosmos that binds together matter, mind, and morality. To walk for a while in that imagination is to feel the boundaries between self and world loosen, to sense that in every breath, every heartbeat, every act of kindness or cruelty, the great play of roots, love, and strife is going on. And it is to be confronted with a question that Empedocles would have thought urgently practical. In that play, which side are you on?
Midnight rails on her silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. The horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain, where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else. to be. No.